Buddhist Summer School, Saturday, 23rd August 1980. If we wish to master a language, a new language which we do not know, we have to start at the beginning. We have to start with the alphabet itself. And a mastery of the alphabet goes a very, very long way to the mastery of all that is built up on that alphabet. The alphabet and the words, and then later on the sentences which have any meaning to them and which can be used for the purposes of right communication, all grow out of our actual living experience. That is one of the most wonderful things about language, that it grows out of the living experience of people and the process of development of the people themselves. Their development in terms of understanding, of character, as well as of their outlook on life and everything that composes their life. That's why language is of very great importance. The spoken word. In fact, the word has been regarded with such has been regarded as being of such importance through the ages that time and again, when the great teachers of the world suggested how the universe came into being, they said, in the beginning was the word. And the word, as you know, since you are all, practically all of you are members of European Christian civilization, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the word God, of course, is unknown as far as its true meaning is concerned to all of us. It is the mysterious unknown, the unknowable, that primordial, original, creative power through which the entire universe comes into being and is dissolved again and taken back. And the meaning of, and what underlies the statement that in the beginning was the word, is not that it was a word in a particular language in our sense, but it was a vibration, a power which brought the universe into being, a creative power which remains a mystery and probably will remain a mystery always to us limited, finite, mortal individuals. However, the fact that the great spiritual teachers and the founders of the religion spoke in such terms gives us some indication of the importance of the word. Now, I've said all this because I thought it might be useful for us to consider some of the first words we say when we become interested in the Buddha and Buddhist teaching. The refuges which we take, as we say. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. I go to the Buddha as my refuge. Let us look at these words. Gacchāmi, we start with. And we say, I go. Supposing we said, I am going. What is the implication of that? I am going. Something which is in the active present and therefore is taking place continuously. Therefore, it is something which affects the totality of our life and our being. And the going is of a total and complete nature if it is a true going. And this is the great question. When I say, I am going to the Buddha as my refuge, am I really doing it? It's something which we ought to be very much awake to. Whether our going is a true going, or is it an automatic conventional repetition of words? If it is a mere mumbling of words, what is its use? What is its significance? In fact, it has none. So it is very well worthwhile thinking of Gacchami as I am going, as I keep on going all the time, without let or hindrance, without stopping. Think of its implication. How do we live? We live in terms of feeling, of thinking, of desiring, of striving, of experience, and of action, and so on. We live in all those, in all these terms. And we keep on, we have to keep on going in all these terms towards the Buddha. Then the Gacchami becomes a living reality in our lives, something of power. Otherwise, it has not much value. The motive, the driving power, has to be there. So we can next ask, what is it that moves us to go in this manner? What is the reason why we are moved this way? Are we moved by intellectual interest, as very many people are, including, of course, scholars, good scholars too? It's just an intellectual interest, something which does not change their being, their own actual nature. And this is the important thing, because the whole of religion and religious living is directed towards the transformation of the whole individual as such. And if it doesn't do that, or if it doesn't really contribute to that, it is not religious living. We are still ordinary worldlings, puthujjana, as the Buddha said. So intellectual interest alone is insufficient. And intellectual interest, the satisfaction of intellectual interest, is the satisfaction of a pleasure drive within us. And the satisfaction of the pleasure drive is precisely something which does not conduce to religiousness. Also, we must bear in mind that the pleasure drive is invariably and inevitably associated with pain. First, there is pleasure. Then there is the ending of pleasure, and the desire for the repetition of the pleasure. And if it cannot be repeated, then there is pain, there is misery. So that in every case, the pleasure drive ends with pain, sooner or later. Of course, if it ends sooner, all the better, provided we are willing to learn. If we are obstinate, not willing to learn, then we keep on repeating our mistakes and suffer more and more. And worse than that, we cause suffering to those around us and spread suffering through our environment. So mere intellectual interest and the satisfaction of the pleasure drive, the satisfaction of the drive for intellectual pleasure is not a worthy motivator. Are we driven by ambition? We read of man's fulfillment as consisting of this or the other state, something to achieve, something to attain. And we are driven by ambition to attain this. But every drive of ambition is a sorrow producer. It's a destructive agent, whatever that ambition may be, whether it be to invent a new kind of machine or whether it be to strive to be one with the divine or realize nirvana or something like that. All ambition is self-oriented. And whatsoever is self-oriented, that is to say, oriented to one's own self exclusively, it may include one or two or more others, but usually it is exclusively selfish as such. And the drive of ambition will only bring destruction and suffering in its path. And also, the drive of ambition is so tied up with our vain egoistic urge. It's a vain egoistic urge, ambition. Or is it due to preferential choice? One prefers this to something else. Why do we turn to Buddhism? Why, supposing we were born Hindus or Christians or Zarathustrians, why do we turn to Buddhism? Why do we prefer this? Why do we think that this is better? If we look deeply into our own, the workings of our own minds and hearts, we will find a deep-seated selfishness involved in this preferential choice. It is a self-serving, and also it involves a considerable self-conceit. We think we know how to make a choice. Also, we forget all the time that every time we make a choice, unless the choice is wholly unself-centered, and that happens very rarely, unless the choice is wholly self-centered, we always introduce the element of conflict, of splitting apart from someone else or something else. And so, a preferential choice is usually destructive. We may prefer, of course, to take to the teachings of the Buddha, because being what each one of us individually is by nature, we may find that the Buddha's teachings are most agreeable to us, that they suit our temperament and so forth. But consider that very, very carefully. Consider all its implications. It suits me, this big I am, this wretched little me, the source of practically all the misery of the world, is all the time being pandered to, is all the time being served by a preferential choice. And we also imagine that that we know how to make a choice, that we are always right in our choice. But if we look very deeply, we will find that in most cases, the majority of cases, our choice is faulty, to put it mildly. So preferential choice should really be out of the situation. Then there are some who will take to a particular faith to a particular mode of life and so on, in order to please and ultimately possess X or Y, whosoever they are in love with, or something like that. Well, all right, and supposing they succeed in doing that, what happens after a time? Consider very, very carefully. This which was done in the name of one of the most powerful influences in life, the religious feeling and the religious drive. If in the name of the religious drive we serve our personal desires, whatever they be, whether they be socially acceptable or unacceptable, whether they be moral or unmoral, whatever they be, then the final result is extremely painful. If you do a wrong in the name of God, you will probably find much more unpleasant karma come upon you than if you did it in the name of yourself, who is, of course, the devil. I should have said myself, who am the devil. So beware of that. Beware of taking to what we believe to be true and good and so forth, in order that ultimately we may serve ourselves. Now consider, finally, am I moved to go to the Buddha because of suffering, as we say in the English language, dukkha, dukkha, suffering, pain, misery, unsatisfactoriness, and so forth? Are all these meanings up to much? Consider this very, very deeply indeed, because this goes right into the very heart of all the motives that move us to live the religious life. The word dukkha has a transcendental meaning. It means far from the infinite. It means that which has spoilt the stainless, or tried to spoil the stainless, the perfect. Dukkha, the Sanskrit form of it. You will find Buddha Ghosha expounding this in his Visuddhimagga. And I think that that is one of the finest meanings of dukkha. That it is far from the ultimate reality, from the supreme, the perfect. So now, the next point to consider in relation to that is, whose dukkha? My own dukkha? But can my own dukkha, put in those exclusive terms, really have sufficient bearing in relationship to this this complete and total meaning of dukkha? Far from the infinite, far from that which is nirvana itself. My own cannot, because if I am concerned with my own, I've separated myself from everything else. So that is insufficient as such. Can it be your dukkha? In which case, I might imagine that I am moved by an altruistic drive, that I'm really altruistic moving towards the Buddha. But if I do that, then I have made just an exclusive relationship with 1 or 2 or 20 people, as the case may be, and all the rest are out of the situation. But if all the rest are out of the situation, if all the rest of the universe is out of the situation, this does not fulfill the complete and transcendental meaning of dukkha, which includes the total, the one total reality, whatever it is. So it cannot be just your dukkha that I'm concerned with. Is it mankind's dukkha? Yes, I may say mankind's dukkha, but then I'm separating out mankind from the rest of creation. But supposing we say it's the world's dukkha, using the word world in the sense of the entire cosmos, the total cosmos, all existence itself. All existence spells dukkha. It's far from the infinite. How and why? That which exists is that which stands out of the absolute totality, the ultimate reality, whatever that reality may be. X out of sistere, to stand out of. That is the meaning of to exist. An existence is a standing out of the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality. So, if I am moved by the suffering by the world's suffering, and it is existence which suffers, not the ultimate reality as such. The ultimate reality subsumes suffering just as it subsumes happiness, fulfillment, and so on. If I say it is the whole world's suffering, then perhaps at last I'm beginning to have something like a whole relationship with dukkha as such. And the value of having a whole relationship with dukkha is that in one's own being, one absorbs, in one's own psychical nature, one absorbs the suffering of the world, of the whole world. One is sensitive to the whole of it all the time. And being sensitive to it the whole of the time, one is not insensitive to opposite dual happiness and well-being, fulfillment, because of the fact of true happiness and well-being in the religious sense of the word. We have this marvelous teaching of mudita when we talk of the Brahma Viharas. Mudita, being able to participate in the joys as well as the sorrows of the world through compassion. And in that sort of whole relationship with dukkha, it becomes possible through our own development, our own devoted living of the religious life, to affect not just ourselves but to affect all mankind. If your consciousness, your individual consciousness, undergoes transformation, you transform the consciousness of the entire world. It's very difficult to offer any proof or evidence of it. But if one practices carefully and observes very intently and very purely, one will see that this is just what does happen. Otherwise, there is no movement forward at all. The real transformation of your own consciousness affects the consciousness of the totality. So, if I'm moved in that manner, then I am truly going, in the full sense of the word, gacchami, to the Buddha as such. Now take the middle word, saranam. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Saraṇaṃ. It is translated usually as refuge. I go to the Buddha as a refuge. But a refuge is a place to which you fly. Fly away from danger, fly away from your pursuer, fly away from the law when it wants to lay its hands on you, and you go into the temple and stand by the altar and the law can't touch you, and so on. Saranam, refuge. It is more, to me, it seems more related to the idea of escape. But are we escapologists? On the other hand, are we going to turn around and face the enemy, so-called, face the danger, the difficulty, and put ourselves in conflict with it? Then too there will be destruction. How shall we regard Saranam? So that there is no destruction, there is no wrong action involved anywhere, there is no splitting asunder or an attempt to split asunder the unity of the universe. Look at that word universe, it's a wonderful word. A one thing. So, how are we going to regard Saranam? Supposing we regard it as a port of destination. We are moving towards the Saranam, whether we are conscious of it or not, whether we will it or not, whether we deliberately work in harmony with the laws of life and come to fruition or not. Life is invincible. It moves us onwards. And life is a characteristic of the supreme reality, of the total reality. You know how in the Chandogya Upanishad of the Brahmanical teachings, it is said that Brahman is prana, Brahman is life. Obviously it cannot mean merely biological life, but it is life in its totality. And life is a word whose full meaning we are unaware of. We don't know what it means. In its fullness. So, if we are aware of Saranam as the port of destination towards which we move, in harmony with the totality of life, then perhaps the word Saranam may have a meaning of tremendous significance to us, of tremendous promise, and it would give us all that is necessary in the way of the power to continue in spite of difficulties and so forth, to move towards that Saranam. And it will be not only for our own sakes, but it will be something which is in accord with the movement of the whole universe. And then finally, the word Buddha, Buddham. Go to the Buddha. Does any one of us really know what the word Buddha implies? The tremendous implication of the all-enlightened, the perfected Holy One, it's so deep, it's so great, that the poverty-stricken brain of one individual like myself cannot possibly conceive of it. It is beyond all conception. And yet, there are some words in the language of such potency that they can give us an indication. We say the Buddha, if we say that the Buddha is the one who has realized Samma Sambodhi, perfect enlightenment, the supreme enlightenment. That means that through him, the whole of the power and the wisdom of the universal process works freely without hindrance. He is the nexus of transcendence, through into whom and through whom transcendent creative energy continuously flows. This is one of, for me, one of the great implications of the word Buddha. And this can happen only if there is the complete harmony of transcendent love and transcendent wisdom of Mahakaruna and Mahaprajna. Both have to be there in order that this power may flow freely without hindrance from us. And it flows through the finite individual. That's the marvel of the whole thing, the miracle, that through the finite individual, the infinite, immortal, supreme, whatever it is, functions without let or hindrance. The perfect mind. So, perhaps those three words, Buddham, Saranam, Gacchami, mean an immense amount which we ought to pay attention to and see what depth of meaning we can extract out of it. So tomorrow we will perhaps take another step forward, if possible, from there.